Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Colts, Hidden Killers Investigates. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
On March 31st of 2008, a caller contacted a Texas crisis center. She's saying she's a 16-year-old girl living at the Yearning for Zion Ranch. I know, we've all wanted to go there. Outside of El Dorado, Texas. She says she's married to a 50-year-old man. She says he beats her. She says he forces himself on her. She says she has a baby and is expecting another child. Well, Texas authorities mobilized, and on April 3rd, law enforcement arrives at the ranch with armored vehicles, a search warrant, and the memory of Waco seared into every tactical decision they make. Over the following days, they remove more than 460 children from the compound. It's the largest child custody action in United States history. And here's the fun part. The caller wasn't even real. Her name was Rosita Swinton. She was 33 years old, a woman in Colorado with a documented history of making false reports to authorities across multiple states. She had triggered a large-scale emergency response before, posing as different people in different jurisdictions. In this case, she alternated between personas, sometimes identifying as a 16-year-old, sometimes as the girl's sister. She had never set foot on the YFZ Ranch, Yearning for Zion Ranch. She had never been a member of the FLDS. Flora Jessup, a former FLDS member and advocate, recorded nearly 40 hours of Swinton's phone calls, both before and after the raid. The phone call that triggered the largest child removal operation in American history was a fabrication from start to finish. Texas authorities had later acknowledged they could not locate the caller, but by then the investigation had taken on a momentum of its own. So its intent, its purpose, did something quite good. If you can't get through, people aren't taking the action they need to, sometimes a good old prank call gets it done. What investigators found inside that ranch was not fabricated. It was documented, photographed, cataloged, and eventually presented to a jury. And it was worse than the hoax caller described. This is part four of our five-part series on Warren Jeffson, the FLDS. We have covered the rise, the machine, the manhunt. Now comes the reckoning and the moral complexity that makes it impossible to look away. Love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through this. Let's go back to the Yearning for Zion Ranch. Built on 1,700 acres of West Texas scrubland that Warren Jeffs had quietly purchased under the pretense of a hunting retreat. I guess it was kind of hunting for people. By 2008, it had grown into a self-contained FLDS community, housing more than 700 people, far more than law enforcement had estimated. There were homes, workshops, agricultural land, a school, and at the center of everything, a massive limestone temple that Warren Jeffs had ordered constructed. It was the first temple in FLDS history. And what was inside that temple is the reason this case went from a custody dispute to a criminal prosecution. According to evidence recovered during the raid and testimony from former members, the temple contained beds where so-called celestial marriages were consummated. These were the rooms where underage girls were brought after being given to adult men in ceremonies performed by Jeffs or his designated lackeys. A handwritten ledger, which investigators called the Bishop's Record, documented marriages of girls as young as 12. The temple was not a house of worship. It was a crime scene with a steeple. Texas authorities said approached the raid with extreme caution. Again, the ghost of the 1993 Branch Davidian siege in Waco, just a few hundred miles from El Dorado, hung over every decision. Ambulances were staged nearby in case things went wrong. Communication channels were kept open with Merrill Jessup, who ran ranch operations. De-escalation was the priority at every stage. No shots were fired during the operation. No one was physically harmed. In that narrow sense, the raid was a success. In every other sense, it was the beginning of a legal, moral, and human catastrophe that is going on to this day. Over the course of several days, the Texas authorities removed more than 460 children and hundreds of women from the ranch. The scale overwhelmed every system built to handle it. There were not enough foster homes. There were not enough attorneys. The San Angelo Coliseum was converted into temporary housing. More than 350 lawyers stepped forward to represent the children. Mothers were separated from infants. Children were scattered across the state, some transported hours away to Boys and Girls Ranches that served as emergency foster placements. FLDS mothers wrote letters to the governor describing their children's distress, alleging that the conditions in temporary shelters were making their children sick, that the interrogation sessions were traumatizing, that invasive physical examinations and pregnancy tests were being conducted on girls without proper consent or explanation. Well, tough shit. You should have been a parent first time. Sorry. Yeah, it's horrible. It's traumatizing. But it's not quite as bad as, you know, temple sex. Or temple R is more like it, because that was not anything consensual. So before you get all your in a bundle. But again, these people aren't seeing it that way because they're cult members. Because they've been brainwashed, because they think their way is the right way, the only way. Anybody coming in and disrupting that, well, that's of the devil. State officials defended the removal, saying the ranch was not a safe environment and that evidence of physical and ass abuse was present. The governor's office received daily briefings. The state bar mobilized volunteer attorneys at a pace normally reserved for natural disasters. And then the public opinion turned. Because the FLDS, in their infinite wisdom, launched a media campaign that was far more sophisticated than anyone expected from a community that banned television. They presented monogamous families to reporters. They lied. They put on a fake scene that the American public ate up. Oh, these poor people, these simpletons being persecuted by the government. They put forward young parents who looked exactly like any other American couple, asking reasonable-sounding questions. Why was their children taken? Where is the evidence against their specific family? How can the state remove an entire community's children based on a phone call that turned out to be fake? The images that circulated, women in prairie dresses, weeping, children being loaded into buses, echoed the 1953 Short Creek disaster that had haunted law enforcement for half a century. And that was the purpose. That was the plan. They knew they could weaponize the public's stupidity to their own advantage. It was a political calculus. And it was shifting. The Texas Supreme Court ruled that the state had overstepped, believe it or not. Children were then ordered returned to their families. Amazing what public pressure can do when it comes to getting votes over actual well-being of human beings. But that's nothing new. The court held that the state had not demonstrated an individualized risk for each child removed, and that group membership alone did not constitute grounds for removal. The ACLU issued a statement raising concerns about the scope of the operation. Critics argue that a hoax phone call should never have been the basis for the largest child seizure in American history. Defenders countered that it did not matter how the investigation started. What mattered is what it found. Both sides did have a point, and neither side had a clean answer. The trigger was fraudulent. The response was arguably overboard by some. The abuse was undeniably real. Justice arrived through the wrong door. But what door do you go in when this is happening? But they still found what they needed finding. That tension between the methods and the outcome is the moral center of this entire episode. There is no comfortable resolution. You sit with it. Here's what investigators found inside the ranch. The bishop's record documenting underage marriages. Photographs of Warren Jeffs with a preteen girl in ceremonial settings. The Texas Department of Family and Protective Services determined that the girls between 14 and 17 years living at the ranch, more than one in four, was either in an underage marriage or pregnant. That's a good reason to take all the kids. Medical examiners identified dozens of children whose histories had bone fractures. CPS investigators also uncovered potential abuse of boys documented in diary notes taken during interviews. And most critically for the criminal case, investigators found evidence tying Warren Jeffs directly to two specific victims. A 12-year-old girl and a 15-year-old girl who later gave birth to his child. Audio recordings existed, Jeff's own voice on tape in the room during the assaults. Before Texas could try him, the Utah case played out first. In 2007, Jeffs was convicted in St. George on two counts of being an accomplice to the assault of Alyssa Wall through her forced marriage. He was sentenced to 10 years to life, but in 2010, the Utah Supreme Court overturned the conviction, ruling that the trial judge had given the jury flawed instructions. Specifically, the court held that the jury should have been told Jeffs could only be convicted if he intended for Alyssa's husband to engage in non-consensual acts. The legal system failed Alyssa Wall on a technicality. She had carried the weight of that testimony for years, and a procedural error erased the result. Texas said they're not going to make the same mistake. In 2011, the trial in San Angelo became one of the most disturbing courtroom proceedings in recent American legal history. Jeffs chose to represent himself. He made rambling, incoherent statements to the court. He issued prophecies from the defense table, warning the judge and jury that God would bring destruction upon anyone who proceeded against him. He objected to testimony on religious freedom grounds. He attempted to turn the trial into a stage for his theology. At one point, he stood silent at the podium for nearly an hour. The judge allowed him to continue representing himself, but appointed standby counsel to step in if necessary. None of it worked. When prosecutors played the audio recordings, Jeff's own voice instructing the children brides during the assaults, recorded in what he described as a ritualistic setting inside a temple, jurors wept. Several left the courtroom. The evidence was not circumstantial. It was not testimony that could be challenged or reinterpreted. It was the defendant's own voice. Creepy, as always, preserved on tape, doing exactly what he was charged with doing. You're like, why does he keep talking like that? Because that's how Warren Jeffs talks. Do a little Googling. Yeah, it's Warren Jeffs was found guilty of ass assault of a child for the assault of a 15-year-old girl, and aggravated ass of that child. The jury deliberated for less than 30 minutes. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years and fined $10,000. According to a former federal prosecutor involved in the case, evidence presented during the sentencing phase indicated that Jeffs had been involved in arranging the marriages of dozens of underage girls to FLDS men. And then he personally had approximately 78 wives of his own, with as many as 24 of them being underage at the time of the marriage. After the conviction, Jeffs issued an order from prison. Abandon the YFZ ranch, the yearning for Zion Ranch. But it's such a nice place. Families scattered to smaller FLDS outposts across the country, Utah, Arizona, South Dakota, even Canada. Some went to remote properties that had been quietly purchased in Jeff's name or through shell companies controlled by his brothers. The state of Texas seized the YFZ property in 2014. There remained in litigation from a former member for years afterwards. The limestone temple still stands in the desert, empty. The beds are still inside. 11 men connected to underage marriages at the ranch received prison sentences for crimes ranging from bigamy to SA. But many community members had returned to the ranch within a year of the initial raid, living there for years as if nothing had happened until Jeff's order finally emptied it. The raid that was supposed to end things had become, in the FLDS faithful telling, just another chapter in the story of their persecution. Alyssa Wall, the woman whose testimony had secured the first conviction only to see it overturned, wrote a book about her experience. It's called Stolen Innocence, and became one of the most visible survivors of the FLDS. She would later appear in documentaries and continue pursuing Jeffs through civil courts, determined that the man who took her childhood would not keep his money. Her courage opened the doors for dozens of others, but the road from testimony to justice was measured in years. The scars it left were permanent. The trial proved that survivors, what they had been saying for years was true. The evidence was unambiguous. The sentence was life without the possibility of parole. And inside the FLDS, the faithful said it provided something else entirely. They said the prosecution was persecution. They said their prophet was being punished for his faith. They said the recordings were taken out of context. They said he would someday go free. The jury heard Warren Jeff's voice on those tapes and needed less than a half hour to convict and a bath in Purell. The FLDS faithful heard the same recordings and called it martyrdom. The same evidence, two completely different realities. That is how deep indoctrination can go. That is the machine Warren Jeffs built. A system so effective that even the sound of its architect committing the crime is not enough to break the spell. In part five, The Prophet in a Cell, how Warren Jeffs is still running the FLDS from prison, the $152 million judgment survivors may never collect, and the question this series ends on, is it over? Give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue it there. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts on your device. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is, hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our reporting on this and the next chapter in the story. If you want to get advanced access to it right now, well, all you got to do is become a member on YouTube. And you can get access to all of our videos as we make them, before they get published, sometimes days, sometimes weeks in advance. You can binge away right now. Anyway, check that out. All right. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.